This is the WGNS Action Line, talking with Rutherford County newsmakers about what matters most to you.
Your host, J. Paul Newman of the monthly District Attorney Show.
The viewpoints and opinions expressed on this broadcast are the viewpoints and opinions of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the viewpoints and opinions of this show, its host, or the management of this station. You are listening to WGNS. We welcome everyone to the program. My name is J. Paul Newman. My co-hosts today are Rutherford County District Attorney General Jennings Jones and Rutherford County Assistant District Attorney Trevor Lynch. We thank WGNS for providing the airtime, and we also thank our producer, Scott Walker. Most of all, we thank you for listening. We will begin our broadcast after you listen to these important messages.
50 fresh, flavorful seasons at the Rutherford County Farmers Market.
You bringing your tomatoes this Friday?
Sure am. Pick fresh this morning.
And I'll bring the sourdough.
Rutherford County Farmers Market, Tuesdays and Fridays, 7 to 1, at Lane Agri Park in Murfreesboro.
This is Doris Sand with the Rutherford County Farm Bureau. We would like to show our appreciation to all of our Farm Bureau members by inviting you to our annual membership meeting Monday, August the 4th at the Lane Agri Park, 315 John Ross Boulevard. We will start serving barbecue with all the trimmings at 5 p.m. The meeting will be immediately following. For more information, call 615-893-1213 or visit our website at rcfarmbureau.org.
The Action Line on FM 101.9 and AM 1450 Murfreesboro, FM 100.5 Smyrna, and streaming at WGNSradio.com.
Host J. Paul Newman heard exclusively on News Radio WGNS.
In our cold case profile segment, we will highlight three unsolved murders. They are the 2019 murder of Terrell Ray, the 2016 murder of Fausto Hernandez, and the 2009 murder of Anthony Davis. To discuss those cases, we will welcome Detective James Abbott from the Murfreesboro Police Department.
Every homicide, every rape, every robbery affects the entire community. People who are victims of these crimes need closure. The people who committed these crimes must be held accountable. Law enforcement needs the community's help in seeking justice. Please listen as we review an unsolved mystery in this month's Cold Case Profile.
We welcome James Abbott to our microphones. Share with the audience your training, education, and your work experience.
Good morning. My training experience, I've had numerous courses in training in homicide investigations, cold case homicide, murder investigations, interview, interrogation courses, search and seizure, crime analysis. I also have a bachelor's and a master's from Middle Tennessee State University. I'm currently working on my doctorate at University of Tennessee in Chattanooga. Recently completed my coursework, now working on my dissertation there. So, I mean, that's pretty much the extent of my experience. I'm always training. This job is one of those where you're always training.
Today, we are going to be asking for the public's help in solving three unsolved homicides. But before we discuss those three cases, I want to ask you a few questions designed to enlighten the public regarding what is often referred to as cold case investigations. And I know that you have investigated and solved numerous homicides and have testified many times in court. In your training and experience, what category or type of evidence is the most powerful in helping to solve homicides?
One of the most powerful ones is witness statements. If we have witnesses, that's excellent for our investigation. But to be honest with you, it takes a combination of things, particularly to get to a successful prosecution. Fingerprints, blood evidence, as far as DNA, trace evidence, weapons, any type, you know, being able to identify the specific weapon, phone evidence records, text messages, emails, and even social media is now huge for our investigations.
Research shows that homicides are most often solved because somebody tells you something, and that witness statements are the most important type of evidence for solving a homicide. Do you agree with that research? And can you share with us an example of witness statements solving a homicide?
Yeah, I mean, it's very true. Matter of fact, one particular case you and I both worked on, which was the Ellis Wayne Smith homicide. You may remember we had numerous people coming forward saying that they had information about the case. And there was information that we had withheld about the investigation because all these people were giving us all this information coming forward and telling us, but it was all false information. They were looking for maybe a break in the court system themselves or things. So by keep withholding that key information, when we actually did have two individuals that had spoken to the suspect and the suspect had actually told them what happened, when they came forward, it opened up the entire investigation and, of course, led to successful prosecution of the individual himself.
Keeping in mind the importance of witness statements, what factors are helpful in obtaining witness cooperation, in your opinion?
Some of the biggest factors for us is, number one, you have to build rapport and sometimes, in some cases, earn respect with the witness themselves. A lot of it comes down to likability. There's some people that will walk into an interview room and it's like flipping on a light switch. No one wants to talk to them. And it's the same way with, you know, some people walking into a room anywhere. At the other times, there's others that will sit down, become very personal with that person, and they'll get them to talk. And, you know, and also it comes down to getting the community as well, getting information out there to the community. A lot of times community members may hear someone talk about a case, and they're kind of limited on, well, who would they need to talk to? But if you get out there and you talk to people and get that information out there with the community, then they usually know who to talk to. So I always say, you know, you've got to hand out your business cards like a politician. Let everybody know who you are and get that information out there.
What do you believe is the most significant factor or factors for a homicide remaining unsolved?
Usually the most significant factors for us that I have found over the years is a lack of witnesses and a lack of physical evidence. Those are the two key ones that usually hamper our investigations the most.
With that as background, let's profile the three cases that brought you here today. First of all, will you tell us about the May 26, 2009 murder of Anthony Davis?
On May the 26th, 2009, in the early morning hours of that day, a group of males identified as one white male, two Asian males, and a black male entered 2225 Norman Avenue here in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. It was during that time period that two of the males were armed with pistols. One of them was armed with an AK-47. There was other individuals present as well. Mr. Davis was sitting on the couch having a conversation with some individuals. We learned through our investigation that earlier that night, Mr. Davis had been involved in a drug deal that had gone bad over on State Street here in Murfreesboro. During that time period, he had left and gone over to Norman Avenue. These individuals found him over on Norman Avenue, and two of the individuals shot and killed Mr. Davis while he sat on the couch. During that time period, several individuals were interviewed through that initial investigation. Some physical evidence was also recovered. And right now we have three individuals that we have identified that was there, that we were involved. This is one of those cases where we just need one or two more people to come forward to really help us out, those witnesses. If they could come forward, this is one of those cases I believe that could easily move forward in the system, in the court system, and be successfully prosecuted.
Next, can you tell us about the July 15th, 2016 murder of Fausto Hernandez?
On July 15th, 2016, at approximately 9:01 p.m., Mr. Hernandez was seen walking into the neighborhood market and tobacco located at 1208 East Northfield. After spending some time in there and buying the items he was looking for, he exits the market at around 9:06 p.m. at 9:12 p.m., three juveniles who were walking over to the, there was at that time a family video over there, was seen walking over to the video store, and they had observed Mr. Hernandez sitting on a rock behind the Marco's Pizza and the store, talking on a cell phone. Mr. Hernandez's wife, Carmen, was the one he was talking to, and she remembered him hanging up. And then at around 9:15 p.m., about a minute afterwards, her phone rang again, and it was Mr. Hernandez. But this time she stated that she could hear him talking to someone, so it was kind of a pocket dial. So Ms. Hernandez listened on the phone, and then the phone went dead again. At around 9:30 p.m., four more subjects walked by the rock area and saw Mr. Hernandez lying on the ground. They walked over to family video again. They also, too, walked over to family video to call 911. During this same time period, the three juveniles also had just walked out of the store or family video and walked by and seen Mr. Hernandez laying there as well and also called 911. Mr. Hernandez, when police got there and arrived, medical personnel, he was immediately transported to Vanderbilt. The only thing that Mr. Hernandez could say before, due to his extensive injuries, was the only thing he could tell officers and medical personnel on the scene was that a black male had shot him. And after that, Mr. Hernandez was unable to be questioned, and he never recovered from those injuries, and he died at Vanderbilt.
And our final case is the August 2nd, 2019 murder of Terrell Ray.
On August 1st, 2019, Terrell Ray was celebrating his birthday with his friends and family. He had met one of his pastors in Nashville for dinner. They talked about work and other things that he was wishing to do. After having dinner, he went and met up with a friend for a few minutes. They also talked, and then he left Nashville and drove to Murfreesboro. We know that Mr. Ray drove to Murfreesboro. We also know, thanks in part to, at the time, the red light cameras there, that we know that Mr. Ray, when he entered Murfreesboro, nobody was following him. There was no suspicious activity indicating that anyone came from Nashville following him. Mr. Ray drove from Nashville to Murfreesboro in his 2016 Chevrolet Camaro. We know that he arrived at 2:52 a.m., in the city, and then he arrived around 3 a.m. at 2850 Middle Tennessee Boulevard, which is the Villager Apartments. He went to apartment B building, which is where his girlfriend lived. He was coming to see her. She had gotten off work late that night, and he was coming to visit her after she had gotten off work. Mr. Ray parked his vehicle in the parking lot there and started to walk to her apartment. Mr. Ray was confronted by some individuals. We know that Mr. Ray never made it to the apartment. Mr. Ray was confronted by some individuals or near the apartment building. At that time, one of the suspects, Mr. Ray dropped his items that he was in his possession, tried to run to his car, may have even tried to resist in some ways when they're trying to rob him. And Mr. Ray was shot in the back multiple times. The suspects then took Mr. Ray's vehicle. They fled the scene in Mr. Ray's vehicle as well. The vehicle was recovered at around 4:30 a.m. that morning. It was thanks to the GPS that was on the vehicle, we were able to learn that the vehicle arrived at 43rd Avenue North in Nashville at around 4:30 a.m., and we recovered it shortly thereafter. This is one of those cases that really Mr. Ray was just coming to see his girlfriend, and it's one of those cases where it's a tragedy that he was gunned down like that, just like Mr. Hernandez, just like Mr. Davis, gunned down for no reason, for absolutely no reason. There is a $11,000 reward for Mr. Ray's murder case. If anyone has any information, the district attorney's office, General Jones, working with the governor's office, received a $10,000 reward from the governor. And, of course, Crime Stoppers also. And, of course, there's Crime Stopper reward for the other cases as well. If anyone has any information, we would appreciate it.
The Monthly District Attorney Show. Heard the first Friday of each month, exclusively on News Radio WGNS.
Big benefits at Adams Place.
We have a driver who's here from 8 to 4. He will take you anywhere you need to go.
That's Charlotte Gardner.
It's really a big plus getting around when you do not drive.
Move to Adams Place and leave the driving to us.
Hi, this is Terry Deal at Adams Place. Call me for more information about Adams Place. Phone 615-904-9111.
On Memorial.
Across from Walmart.
What's the law?
Time now for an examination of the laws of Tennessee. This is not intended to be legal advice and is being presented solely for the informational benefit of our listening audience. You should always consult with an attorney whenever you need or rely on legal advice.
Hey everyone, my name is Preston Olivier and I'm a rising 2L at Belmont University College of Law. I was born in New Orleans, but I've been living in Middle Tennessee for about 15 years now. I attended Cumberland University for undergrad, where I received a Bachelor of Arts in Humanities and Social Sciences, with a double minor in Criminal Justice and Sociology. I really enjoy learning about our criminal justice system, and I have been having a great time here at the District Attorney's Office for the 16th Judicial District. In my free time, I enjoy playing the piano, woodworking, and playing games with my friends. Today we're going to talk a little bit about what murder and homicide is and what some of the differences are. It's important to note that homicide and murder are two different terms. Homicide is a legally neutral term that refers to the killing of a person by another person. That killing could be criminal, or it could be justifiable or excusable. Murder, on the other hand, is a killing for which the perpetrator is criminally liable. Murder has multiple degrees of liability. Tennessee's homicide crimes include first-degree murder and felony murder, second-degree murder, voluntary manslaughter, reckless homicide, and negligent homicide. First-degree murder is the most serious type of murder as it involves premeditation and a purposeful mindset from the perpetrator. This means that the perpetrator had intended for the victim to die and took the time to reflect on or plan that killing. It is not necessary for a particular amount of time to pass to establish this premeditation requirement, and it's possible for a killer to premeditate a murder within only a matter of seconds. Moreover, some states distinguish between premeditation and deliberation and require both to be proven separately, but Tennessee makes no such distinction. Felony murder is another form of first-degree murder, and it involves a homicide that occurs during the commission of an enumerated felony, which usually includes dangerous crimes such as robbery, burglary, theft, arson, and so on. Second-degree murder is a homicide classified by the presence of implied malice aforethought and where the perpetrator knowingly committed the homicide. A homicide committed knowingly means the perpetrator is substantially certain that death will result. An implied malice aforethought includes the intent to inflict grievous bodily harm or wanton recklessness manifesting extreme indifference or callousness to the value of human life, also known as depraved heart murder. Next is voluntary manslaughter, which is a homicide that usually results from the perpetrator's being in a state of heated passion caused by adequate provocation. Examples of adequate provocation are mutual combat, witnessing a serious assault upon a close family member, or witnessing your partner in the act of adultery. Notably, the first two are not to be confused with self-defense or the defense of others, which are defenses to murder and will be talked about more later. Heat of passion is a state of rage or any intense or enthusiastic emotion that renders the mind deaf to reason and logic, but this does not necessarily mean that the killing was unintentional. Furthermore, heat of passion will not be found when the perpetrators had sufficient time to cool off. Below that is involuntary manslaughter, which, in Tennessee, is an umbrella term for reckless and negligent homicide. These homicide crimes are characterized by less culpable mental states than the aforementioned homicide crimes. Reckless homicide is the killing of another after ignoring a substantial and unjustifiable risk of death. This might occur if an employee ignores safety precautions or procedures at the workplace, which results in a fatal accident. Negligent homicide is the least serious homicide crime, and it is characterized by the killing of another by a risk that the perpetrator should have been aware of. Leaving a child unattended in a hot vehicle, which results in a fatal heat stroke, would be an example of negligent homicide. In this case, while the parent intended no harm to befall the child, the parent should have been aware of the risk of death. And that's a brief overview of the different degrees of murder and various homicide crimes in our criminal justice system, and next is Colton Albright to talk about criminal responsibility.
Hey everyone, this is Cole returning for my second segment in What is the Law? And today I will be talking about criminal responsibility and conspiracy in relation to murder. At its core, criminal conspiracy involves an agreement between two or more individuals to commit an unlawful act. This agreement forms the foundation of the offense, making it possible for individuals to be held accountable for their involvement in planned criminal activities, even if those activities never come to fruition. Under conspiracy law, each member of the conspiracy can be held responsible for the actions of their co-conspirators, even if they were not directly involved in every aspect of the crime. This concept relates to our topic today through felony murder. Felony murder is defined as the following under Statute 39-13-202, Section 2. A killing of another in the preparation of or in the attempt to perpetrate any first-degree murder, arson, robbery, burglary, theft, kidnapping, aggravated abuse of an elderly or a vulnerable adult in violation of Statute 13-15-511, aggravated neglect of an elderly or a vulnerable adult in violation of 39-15-508, aggravated child abuse, aggravated child neglect, or aircraft piracy, etc. The statute goes on to list several more enumerated felonies, which, if undertaken by the defendant, could lead to a felony murder charge. Essentially, felony murder uses the concept of criminal responsibility to hold those who commit the enumerated felonies listed in the statute accountable for the deaths of those who were likely to result from their criminal actions. For example, if Bert and Ernie agree to rob Tim, and then they become co-conspirators, and in the course of that robbery, Tim is killed, both Bert and Ernie are guilty of felony murder. This is true regardless of how Tim is killed. This is true even if, for example, Bert kills Tim by shooting him and Ernie didn't even know Bert had a gun. This concept can be applied to the facts of endless possible scenarios, but it boils down to one simple point. By engaging in an activity so dangerous as robbery or another type of enumerated felony in the statute, individuals or co-conspirators' intentions towards taking the victim's life become irrelevant. If an individual dies as a result of the criminal actions, all involved are guilty of felony murder. And now we have Zach to talk about some defenses to murder.
A defendant charged with a homicide crime has a number of options. Of course, if given the option, a defendant could take a plea deal. Alternatively, for a number of evidentiary reasons, the defendant may bring a motion to dismiss the charge. If these options either fail or are undesirable, the defendant can mount a good old-fashioned defense. But what sorts of defenses are available to the defendant? When the state charges someone with a homicide crime, the state has to prove the elements of that crime beyond a reasonable doubt. Because everyone in America enjoys a presumption of innocence, the defendant has no duty to prove anything. Thus, many defendants simply contest that the state has proven the elements and may present evidence to weaken the state's proof. Beyond simple defense against the state's proof, someone charged with murder may admit to the killing, but attempt to prove facts that reduce or eliminate criminal liability. A defendant may affirmatively defend themselves in a number of ways that, broadly speaking, fall into two categories: justification and excuse. The difference between these categories is implied by their names. A homicide is justified if circumstances warranted the killing. A homicide is excused if circumstances made it so that the defendant can't be blamed for it. In other words, someone with a valid justification can't be held criminally responsible because they did the right or reasonable thing, whereas someone with a valid excuse might have done the wrong thing, but it wasn't their fault in a way that warrants criminal punishment. The most commonly known justification for homicide is self-defense or defense of others. To succeed in a claim of self-defense or defense of others requires that the defendant acted on an honest and reasonable belief of imminent danger of death or serious bodily harm to himself or another, and that his actions were necessary to avert the danger. In Tennessee, a defendant goes about asserting self-defense or defense of others in a homicide case by submitting evidence sufficient for the court to rule that there is a legitimate jury question of self-defense. If the court so rules, the burden shifts to the prosecution to prove that the defendant did not act in self-defense or defense of another. Perhaps the most famous example of an excuse for homicide is insanity. Defendants are presumed sane, so a defendant asserting the defense of insanity must prove by clear and convincing evidence that they were unable to appreciate the nature or wrongfulness of their actions. That's a serious burden, and it's generally a finding based on expert testimony. So contrary to popular media, faking insanity isn't a great idea. To prevent surprise, defendants are required to disclose their intent to assert insanity to the prosecution in writing. If a defendant is found not guilty by reason of insanity, then the court will order an evaluation to determine what steps are necessary to keep the defendant and the public safe. A defendant who successfully asserts a justification or excuse will not face criminal punishment. But there are also ways to defend against a homicide charge that merely reduce the defendant's level of culpability. Preston got at this earlier when he described the different categories of homicide crimes and the levels of culpability related to each. Someone charged with murder may, for example, attempt to prove that they acted in the heat of passion under adequate provocation, which, if successful, would bring the conviction down from some form of murder to voluntary manslaughter. So, to recap, there are many crimes that fall under the broad label of homicide. Preston told us about first and second degree murder, voluntary and involuntary manslaughter, and reckless and negligent homicide, and how each of those crimes involves a different level of culpability, a different type of intent, and can be proven in a number of ways. Further, there are ways other than killing people to end up on the hook for homicide. As Cole told us, involvement in or association with a crime that results in a death can make someone guilty of murder even if they didn't pull the trigger. And finally, I told you about the number of ways a person who stands accused of homicide can defend themselves. They might do absolutely nothing, negotiate a plea deal, assert a justification or excuse, or try to mitigate intent. This has been What's the Law. Thanks to WGNS for having us on, and thank you, the listeners, for sticking around.
And listeners, before we begin our next segment, I do want to take the opportunity to have Mr. Parker Gasway, who has been a rising 3L law student, who has had his opportunity to perform in court with a limited license, take a few minutes to tell us about the experiences he's had while at the district attorney's office. Parker?
Hello, everyone. My name is Parker Gasway, and I'm a rising 3L at Belmont Law School. This summer, I've had the opportunity to do some pretty cool things in court because of my limited license. A limited license gives me the opportunity to participate in various legal proceedings under the supervision of an experienced attorney. Probably the coolest thing that I was able to do because of my limited license was because I was able to sit and participate throughout a homicide trial. This is an awesome experience for me for a few reasons. For starters, it's a homicide trial. This is something that many law students dream about. The stakes were high for the two defendants, so this made the trial that much more interesting. Additionally, because of my limited license, I got to participate throughout the trial. I got to read the indictments to the court. During this, I told the jury what the two defendants were being charged with. I also got to read two stipulations to the jury. These stipulations were from two different TBI agents who were not able to come to court. I read to the jury what the agents would have testified to. After this, my participation throughout the trial was limited, but I was able to sit with Mr. Lynch and Ms. Chisholm Hall. I helped them by taking notes and keeping track of their evidence. I would like to thank Mr. Lynch and Ms. Chisholm Hall for giving me the opportunity to help out on this case. Now, I will hand it over to the district attorney, Mr. Jennings Jones, to discuss what's inside the courts.
WGNS Action Line, talking with Rutherford County newsmakers about what matters most to you. Weekday mornings at 8:10 on News Radio WGNS. The Braves, MTSU, local sports. Yeah, we got them. Your local sports connection is WGNS.
AM, FM, online.
Discover hidden treasures at the Garden Patch Thrift Shop on Spring Street in Murfreesboro. Whether you're searching for stylish clothing, sturdy furniture, or even large appliances, we've got them all at prices that you'll love. But here's the best part. 100% of your purchase supports Greenhouse Ministries, serving over 70 families a day. Your shopping dollars go straight back into the community, making a real impact. Shop smart and give back at the Garden Patch Thrift Shop on Spring Street in Murfreesboro.
This is Inside the Courts, a look at this month's trials, pleas, and grand jury action. Inside the Courts is presented as a courtesy of the Rutherford County Clerk's Office.
Good morning, everyone. This is your District Attorney General, Jennings Jones, and today I will be your tour guide through this episode of Inside the Courts. We begin this segment by stating that none of the defendants named in any upcoming trials or hearings have been convicted, and they are presumed by our law to be innocent. With that as a prelude, we will now go inside the courts. On April 6th of 2022, officers with the Murfreesboro Police Department responded to an apartment on Las Casas Road and located a deceased male identified as Ryan Walcott. Mr. Walcott's roommate found Mr. Walcott lying on the floor. Mr. Wilcott had been deceased for a minimum of 24 hours, and the cause of his death was determined to be from multiple stab wounds and multiple blunt force trauma injuries. Mr. Wilcott's roommate had been staying with a female friend for a few days. The roommate advised of a third roommate, Mr. Alistair Jennings. Mr. Jennings had a known drug problem and a history of violence. Mr. Jennings was located and interviewed, initially denying living at the apartment and denied knowing the victim. Mr. Jennings claimed he had entered the apartment before, but only through the window and did not have a key to the door. However, Mr. Jennings was found to be in possession of keys to the apartment. This was of note because the victim's body was blocking the front door and evidence showed the window was unlocked. Mr. Wilcott's roommate had advised officers that the doorway is blocked, but he could not see Mr. Wilcott. Responding officers had to use force to make entry into the apartment. Mr. Jennings later confirmed he did know the victim and did live at the apartment. Mr. Jennings also had several cuts on his hands consistent with offensive wounds, injuries caused during an assault of another with a knife. He initially denied any altercation with Mr. Wilcott, but Mr. Jennings was wearing a hospital band, and officers obtained his medical records. Mr. Jennings reported to the hospital staff that he had been in a fight with his roommate. Mr. Jennings was charged with first-degree murder and aggravated assault, resulting in death. He appeared before the General Sessions Court for a preliminary hearing on September the 12th of 2022, and the matter was bound over to the Rutherford County Grand Jury. On June 25th of this year, Mr. Jennings entered a plea of guilty to second-degree murder and received a 22-year sentence to be served in the Tennessee Department of Corrections. The defendant was represented by counsel, Mr. Ben Wetzel, and the state was represented by Assistant District Attorney Matt Westmoreland. On February 18th of 2024, officers with the Murfreesboro Police Department responded to a 911 call regarding DeMarcus McClinton breaking into the residence of his ex-girlfriend, Tashaw Edwards, and her infant. Mr. McClinton kicked in the door of the apartment and physically assaulted Ms. Edwards and her child. 911 was called immediately by others and officers responded quickly. Mr. McClinton was charged with aggravated burglary, aggravated assault, domestic assault, and child abuse. A preliminary hearing was held on March 19th of last year, and the matter was bound over to the grand jury. On May 22nd of this year, a jury trial began, and on May 23rd, a jury of his peers convicted Mr. McClinton of all charges. A sentencing hearing is scheduled for August the 19th of this year. The defendant was represented by counsel, Mr. Ben Wetzel, and the state was represented by Assistant District Attorney Dana Miner. On January 15th of 2023, officers with the Murfreesboro Police Department responded to an apartment on Cobalt Row regarding a shooting that had occurred during the early morning hours. It was reported that two victims had been at the apartment, and when they left, they were followed by the defendant who drove alongside and then behind them. Around the intersection of South Rutherford Boulevard and MLK Jr. Boulevard, the defendant began to fire into the car of the victims. Bullets struck the rear passenger door, the headrest of the front passenger seat where one victim was seated, and the front windshield and driver window where the other victim was seated. This shooting was witnessed by a Rutherford County Sheriff's Department deputy who was coincidentally at the intersection traffic light. The deputy pursued the defendant out into the county and back into Murfreesboro, where the deputy was required to terminate his pursuit for safety reasons. Shortly thereafter, the defendant wrecked his vehicle and was arrested by the Murfreesboro Police Department. A preliminary hearing was held on April 23rd of last year, and the court bound the matter over to the Rutherford County Grand Jury. On July 14th of this year, a jury trial was held, and on July 17th, a jury of his peers found Mr. Robertson guilty of two counts of attempted second-degree murder and one count of aggravated assault. The defendant was represented by counsel, Ms. Amanda Gentry, while the state was represented by Assistant District Attorneys Tammy Reddick and Sarah Davis. On August the 17th of 2020, officers with the Murfreesboro Police Department responded to a residence on Fowler Street in reference to a stabbing. Officers located the body of Mr. Gregorio Zatino. Mr. Zatino had been stabbed multiple times, once in the neck, ultimately causing his death. Mr. Zatino was outside when the attack occurred, but was able to stumble inside and make contact with one of his roommates. Mr. Zatino told his roommate that Carmen de la Cruz had stabbed him. Mr. Zatino's blood alcohol content was a .223, and other roommates advised that there had been a verbal argument between Zatino and de la Cruz earlier in the evening. There were no witnesses to the attack. However, officers located three knives in the outside area where the assault took place. Mr. de la Cruz was located, and a search of his car revealed a kitchen knife with Mr. Zatino's blood on it. Mr. de la Cruz told officers that he and Mr. Zatino had gotten into a fight and that Mr. Zatino had pulled a knife on him. He took the knife away from Mr. Zatino and stabbed him. Mr. de la Cruz claimed he did not know how many times. Inconsistency in Mr. de la Cruz's account led officers to charge him with second-degree murder and aggravated assault, resulting in death. A preliminary hearing was held on September 24th of 2020, and the case was bound over to a Rutherford County grand jury. On July 31st of this year, Mr. de la Cruz pled guilty to voluntary manslaughter and received a 7-year sentence to serve in TDOC custody. The defendant was represented by counsel, Mr. Chris Fisher, and the state was represented by Assistant District Attorney Trevor Lynch. On May 18th of 2022, officers with the Murfreesboro Police Department responded to a call of shots fired at a tennis court on campus at Middle Tennessee University. Officers responded and located two gunshot victims, Mr. Hassani Brewer, who later died from his injuries, and Mr. Xavion Amos, who survived his injuries. Detective David Miller with the Murfreesboro Police Department was assigned as lead investigator. From one witness on scene and with the assistance of MTSU security cameras, detectives were able to identify several young males entering the tennis courts just after the graduation ceremony for Riverdale High School students. Two of the individuals, Mr. Brewer and Mr. Amos, had agreed to fight. The fight was observed by four other males, including Mr. Dante Martin, a friend of Mr. Amos. During the course of the fight, Mr. Martin pulled a handgun and began to fire into the fight, striking Mr. Brewer multiple times as well as hitting Mr. Amos. Subsequently, Mr. Martin was charged as a juvenile with first-degree murder and attempted second-degree murder. The state petitioned the juvenile court to transfer Mr. Martin to adult court and be allowed to prosecute Mr. Martin as an adult. A hearing was held and the juvenile court agreed to the transfer. On December of 2023, Mr. Martin was indicted for first-degree murder, attempted first-degree murder, aggravated assault, reckless endangerment, possession of a firearm on school property, employing a firearm during the commission of a dangerous felony, and reckless endangerment. On March 20th of this year, Mr. Martin entered pleas of guilty to second-degree murder and aggravated assault, receiving a sentence totaling 15 years to serve in the custody of the Tennessee Department of Corrections. Mr. Martin was represented by counsel, Mr. Jacob Findlay, and the state was represented by Assistant District Attorney Matt Westmoreland. On February the 27th of 2023, deputies with the Rutherford County Sheriff's Office responded to a business on Halls Hill Pike in reference to an armed subject attacking and attempting to shoot several employees. The employees fought back and were able to subdue the subject, later identified as Eric Buchanan. Mr. Buchanan had been banned from entering the business a few hours earlier. Mr. Buchanan returned with a semi-automatic pistol, walked through the front door, immediately struck an employee in the head with the pistol, and then pointed the pistol at the owner that had banned him and pulled the trigger. Fortunately, the firearm malfunctioned and did not fire. But video surveillance equipment caught the entire incident, and the audio caught the chilling sound of the click when the trigger was pulled while the gun was pointed directly at the owner's head. At this moment, several individuals jumped in to physically restrain Mr. Buchanan until law enforcement arrived. Detective Monica Fonseca was assigned as the lead investigator. After interviewing witnesses and reviewing audio and video recording, Mr. Buchanan was charged with attempted first-degree murder, aggravated assault, possession of a weapon by a felon, and employing a firearm during the commission of a dangerous felony. A preliminary hearing was held in the General Sessions Court on March 23rd of 2023, and the court found probable cause to bind the matter over to the grand jury. In May of 2023, the grand jury returned an indictment on all counts. A trial was held in October of last year, and on October 24th of 2024, a jury of his peers convicted Mr. Buchanan on all counts. On January 31st of this year, Circuit Court Judge Jimmy Turner sentenced Mr. Buchanan to a total effective sentence of 120 years to serve in the custody of TDOC as a career offender. Mr. Buchanan has at least 8 prior felony convictions, several for violent felonies. Mr. Buchanan was represented by counsel, Ms. Jennifer Fiola, while the state was represented by Assistant District Attorneys Matt Westmoreland and Will DeMint. On December 1st of 2021, officers with the Murfreesboro Police Department responded to 1421 Old Las Casas Pike after the body of Shanna Gibson was discovered. Miss Gibson had died from an apparent gunshot wound to the head. Detective Chris Houck of the Murfreesboro Police Department was assigned as the lead investigator. The victim's boyfriend, Myron Jenkins, was missing from the residence, but was later located at St. Thomas Rutherford after his father had attempted to have him admitted. While on scene, officers located a black firearm outside by the driveway. Detectives interviewed Mr. Jenkins and who attempted to feign insanity. Mental health experts determined that Mr. Jenkins was competent and that the defense of insanity was not supported. At the conclusion of Detective Halleck's investigation, Myron Jenkins was charged with first-degree murder. On April 25th of this year, a jury of Mr. Jenkins' peers convicted him, as charged, of first-degree murder in possession of a firearm by a convicted felon. Mr. Jenkins is currently incarcerated at the Rutherford County Adult Detention Center. He was represented by counsel, Mr. Charles Ward, while the state was represented by Assistant District Attorneys Sarah Davis and Dana Miner. And that will conclude today's look inside the courts.
Rutherford Issues with Brian Barrett, hitting right at what matters most to all of us here in the heart of Tennessee. Weekday mornings at 10 on WGNS, AM, FM, and online.
The monthly District Attorney Show, heard exclusively on News Radio, WGNS, the first Friday of each month.
If you missed any part of this program, it will be available shortly as a podcast on the WGNS website. As we end our program today, we thank WGNS for providing the airtime. And we thank our producer, Scott Walker. Most of all, we thank you for listening. We leave now by saying, a safe community is the responsibility of each and every one of us. For my two co-hosts, Rutherford County District Attorney General Jennings Jones and Rutherford County Assistant District Attorney Trevor Lynch, this is J. Paul Newman, bidding all of you a safe and blessed day.
The District Attorney's Office thanks you for listening to today's program. If you have any information regarding criminal activity in our community, please contact one of our law enforcement agencies. The information presented on today's show is solely for informational benefit and not intended to be legal advice. You should always consult an attorney whenever you need or rely on legal advice. Rutherford County's most trusted name in news. Talk Radio WGNS, Murfreesboro.